speaker, Tom Mann from Lethbridge, Alberta. Thank you.
Hi, folks. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Green Acres Group of Alcoholics Anonymous of Lethbridge, Alberta, and the Adam Group of Al-Anon. And I don't know how I'm going to follow this act that we just had from this little Al-Anon, this little Alateen. My W.C. Fields said, the dogs and children, you know, they'll write your act, you know. Anyways, I want to thank the committee for inviting us to share with you this weekend, and it's been just a glorious experience for every one of us. I would like to thank the committee, the people who met me, Kevin, yourself, and Carl, Norm the Hunk, George, Liz, everyone who has made it so comfortable for us. I thought the fireworks display for Cliff was just going overboard a little bit last night. But you can handle it, yeah. We decided to drive down to Oregon, as I've never been in this part of the world before, and as Kevin said, spend a few of those 65 cent dollars. That's spiritual, isn't it? Yeah. Anyways, we took the scenic tour down, and I saw an old drunk sitting at the side of the road, and he said, take away the scenery here and what have you got? Yeah. It's always a pleasure to be reacquainted with people like the Crying Nun, Sister D. And I don't think the Pope knows what he's in for in September when he comes to California. And beautiful Karen here, I know her daughter very well. They live close to us. It's always fun to meet again like this. And then, of course, Hank. I just missed Hank speaking, I think, in Winnipeg. And we have friends in common. I find I'll probably be mentioning the late Mac Cheater, who was a mutual friend of ours and a very wonderful speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hank was saying he's intrigued watching people drinking. He was watching those old ladies drinking martinis the other night. And I was watching an old lady once drinking like that, and she was buying whiskeys and putting in about two or three drops of water in each drink. And this fascinated me, and I went over and I asked her, why do you drink like this? And she says, Fanny, when you get to my age, you can hold your liquor, but you can't hold your water. And what on earth do you say about this lovely Irishman, Cliff, down here? He told us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I'm still confused. Confirmed a lot of things for me. Louis McNeice, the poet, said the Irish are a race of people who shoot straight in the cause of crooked thinking. And this Oceanside story has it made. He reminds me, that's Irish vengeance, of the Irish farmer who was plowing his field, and the little leprechaun jumped out and he said, begorra, I didn't think you little fellas really existed. He said, indeed we do. He said, and we can give you any wish you like. There's only one condition. Whatever I give you, your neighbor Murphy over there, he gets twice as much. But don't let that deter you. Anything your heart desires. So he thought for a while, Murphy, he said, is it very painful to have one testicle removed? I love the theme of your conference here today. There is a historic thread through this theme. It's reminded when Fulton Sheen was a spiritual leader in this country, he came Midwest and he was lost in a little town looking for the town hall, and he stopped a couple of children. He asked this little boy, "Can you show me how to get to your town hall?" And the little fellow said, "Why are you going there?" And he said, "Well, I'm giving a talk there tonight." And the kid said, "What are you speaking about?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to tell all the people in the town how to get to heaven." He said, "My God," the kid said, "and you can't even find the town hall." Well, we had a dear friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, Father Ed Dowling. And Father Ed is a friend of Bill Wilson, great friend of this program. And Father Ed used to say, "If I ever get to heaven, it's going to be from backing out of hell." And I think we can relate to that. And he was sitting one day with Chuck, having a coffee, and he was talking about this heaven, and he made this remark, "I think that heaven is like a new pair of glasses." And this is a beautiful scene. It has been a beautiful experience for myself, and I'm sure for my family to come here. As you've gathered, I live in Canada, and they have two official languages, English and French, and I don't speak either of them. I'm actually half Irish Cliff and half Scot, and that's the dilemma of my life. One half of you wants to get drunk all the time, and the other half won't pay for it. Yeah. Born in a small mining village in Scotland. My father was a coal miner. He had four children, and we were living at the pinnacle of poverty. And I lived with my grandfather, and he wasn't an alcoholic. My mother and father weren't alcoholics. But all my uncles were alcoholics. My two brothers are alcoholics. I think the whole town were alcoholics. There was a lot of fighting in that town. It was half Irish. It was a civil war. Catholic and Protestant fighting there all the time. And we used to say there's only one difference between a wedding in this town and a funeral. There was one less drunk. I went to my father's funeral and met my uncles, and they were all alcoholics. And this is a disease, a family disease, as we know. It's a biogenetic, hereditary condition. It's fatal. And I could really depress you if you didn't have this program. Because in this program, we can create an environment around us where people get well. And if we can't do it for our own families coming behind us, someone else will, as Cliff said last night. There will always be someone to put us together. I wasn't very impressed with things spiritual or religious growing up in this town, as you can imagine. I was a little Catholic boy. Have you heard that before? And I went to school where they told me that to be accepted by God, you had to be perfect. And I didn't quite fit. And then one night I was driving home in my motorcycle and it died. And a bunch of Irish Catholic laborers came over and said, "Let's kick the you-know-what out of this little Protestant here." And before I could make the sign of the cross, they did it. And they left me for dead. So I was hearing things, too, about the will of God. Some baby would die and someone would say, "That's God's will, you know." Or some catastrophe, some guy would be run over by a truck and that was God's will. I got a little bit fearful of this character. I decided I think I'd better keep a step ahead of him if this is what's going on. And I put God on the back burner of my life for a long time. If you had asked me growing up in this little Scottish town, what were my assets and what were my liabilities, I would have told you my liabilities were poverty and my height. You see, everyone in school used to say things like, Tom Melling is so small, he's just a waste of good skin. I don't think that's funny. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and it says we are like people who have lost their legs and won't grow them again. And I've got to bring a box with me from Canada so you can see me. This is actually the one I stand on when I operate on people as a surgeon, because too many of my assistants were getting flipped discs. And my younger brother, I told you we were very poor. He all we could afford was a sense of humor. So he used to make jokes about my father and how poor we were. And I remember them well. Young Jed said to me, I came home last night and I found my father stripping wallpaper off the walls. And he said, good, Dad, we're decorating. And he said, no, son, we're all moving. My mother had a cookbook, I remember, that started, peel two eggs, peel a loaf of bread. Every recipe was pretty bad. In any case, I would have told you my greatest asset was my intelligence, because the teachers were all telling me how intelligent a little fella I was. They were patting me on the head. It didn't help the growth problem. And they told me, they accelerated me through school, and I finished grade 12 at the age of 15. The principal asked me what I'd like to be, and I said I'd like to be a doctor, and he nearly threw up. And I went on to university at 16, and I did a science degree, and then I transferred and I did a medical degree, and I've gone on taking degrees ever since. I have 5 or 6 university degrees now, and Cliff told you about those. Some people insist they were born alcoholics, and I feel I became an alcoholic by degrees. In any case, I was qualified as a doctor. I married a beautiful gal who was the daughter of the new school principal, and I proceeded to make her life an utter hell. I was drafted into the army. We still had draft in England at that time, and I was sent, they felt they needed me in Cyprus for some reason, and I spent 2 years in the conflict in Cyprus, and I saw lots of people, young kids killed over there, and we had a MASH surgical team, and we operated one night and we drank the next night, and we operated the next night in shifts. And I came home from Cyprus with my wife, my first son Michael, a very unhappy, disillusioned young woman, with this bright star of a doctor who was about to commence training as a surgeon. Well, we do a lot of good things in our drinking days, and sometimes for the newcomers we tend to forget that. We come in and we're so low, feel like the hole in the donut, that we don't realize we've done many good things in our life. And I know I did many that I'm quite proud of. I did a lot of useless things too that I'd like to tell you about. But I did finish that training and in Glasgow and Edinburgh and became a surgeon. And the drinking got worse, and I decided for some unknown reason that I would inflict myself on Canada. I was very romantic, and I picked up a magazine one day. There was a surgeon needed in Western Canada beside the Rockies, and I pictured Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald, the Canadian Mounted Police, and moved out west to drink Canada dry. We all arrived in this city of 60,000 unsuspecting souls, and I started my practice of surgery, quotation marks, and practicing all the way my alcoholism. I mentioned those Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and not long after I arrived in Lethbridge, I saw lights behind my car, And that gave a new meaning to Nelson Eddy's song, When I'm Calling You. Yeah? And I had a few encounters with these men over the years. And as I say, did many useless things to qualify for this program. I once went downtown, as someone said, speaking lower company like myself. And I went into the Garden Hotel, which was about the worst you can find. It's not even in existence now. And I went in for a quiet refreshment one night, trying to make my name as a budding surgeon. I got miraculously drunk, tripped over the toilet, and got stuck behind the toilet bowl. And I didn't think that was possible. There I was, with my shoulders wedged in the corner of the toilet. And the more you kick and struggle, the tighter you get impacted in a situation like that, you know? And you get strange things go through your head. Like, why don't they get a better janitorial service? That was number one. And then I would say, what's a man in your position doing in this position? And this is not an illustrious start to a lifetime of meditation, I can assure you. Well, somebody finally pulled me out, as they always have done for years, and I went about my business. And I decided, Tom, what you need is occupational therapy, something to keep you busy. So being an alcoholic, I decided to build a television, not a small television, not a black and white television, a big color television, which I did. And I spent 3 months building this 26-inch color television, and I switched it on. And it worked. Here was a galloping gourmet cooking, bottle of wine in his hand, and I thought this was worth a celebration. So I went downtown, came home drunk, tripped in the carpet, put my head right through the front of my 26-inch television set. And that's a spiritual awakening if you've never had one, because my face was lying open from my eye here to below my ear. My chin was cut. And I was just spouting, and I decided this is no condition to turn myself into my colleagues. So I went down to my own clinic and left a trail of blood for a block and went in and stitched this up without the benefits of local anesthetic. And I missed a bit. I didn't see the bit below my ear. I picked that up in the morning. My nurse came in the next morning. Saw the blood, she wrote a hasty note, moved to Vancouver, and I've never seen her since. Well, I'm making light of this, but as you're well aware, my family life was deteriorating in the extreme. I had two sons had arrived by this time, Alan and Steve. My daughter was born in 1969. We had very little communication between my wife and I. She just could never understand this behavior and could never bring herself to benefit from the program of Al-Anon, although it was discussed many times. My oldest boy, Mike, used to twitch a little when I came in, and used to wonder what kind of father was coming home, and sometimes it disappeared down to the basement. And these were really pretty sickening years for everyone. My wife decided to leave me and went back to England, and I stopped drinking for about 6 weeks. And I flew over to England, prevailed on her to get the family together and come back to Canada. And we did. And shortly after we came back, my wife said to me, you know, Tom, you're doing so well now. You haven't been drinking for weeks. Maybe you could handle a little wine with your meals. Well, that just lit me up like a light bulb. And the only problem was she couldn't cook fast enough. I was drinking wine for breakfast, wine in bed, wine at night. And, you know, of course, where that led. Now, I don't know about you, but when I drank, I was really very unlucky. I had many, many accidents. I don't know why, but I broke my arm 3 times, and I compound fractured my leg, broke my ribs. I went in for an x-ray a few years ago, and the radiologist said, "When did you fracture your spine?" And would you believe I couldn't tell him? I said, "It must have been one of those climbing, mountaineering falls, I think." I've never been up a mountain. Have you ever seen a beer parlor on a mountain? In any case, I had one hit and run about this time. I struck a parked car and I took off, lost the mounted police. And they found me the next day and they took me before the judge. By this time, I was in every committee and I was running the town, I thought. I decided I would discipline myself from the outside. So I ran for school board, was elected. I was president of the medical association. I just joined everything. And I thought I wouldn't have time left to drink. So this judge took me into his private chamber and he said, "You know, if I take you into court, Tom," he said, "you could lose your license." So he fined me. And I walked out of that room, not in the least bit grateful. I said, "Boy, Tom, you have this whole town in your palm of your hand now." And I went straight to the bar. Now, a few years later, I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and sitting at that meeting, North Lestrade, with the barman who served me, the policeman who arrested me, and the judge. You know, every one of us made it to the program. About 6 weeks before I came to you, and I was very ill, I came into the hospital to do a very minor operation, and one of our senior surgeons collapsed at my feet, and he had a complicated bowel obstruction, and he wanted me to operate on him, and I said I wasn't feeling well, which is no lie. And then his wife called me, and she coaxed me to operate on John. Well, I went home and I drank the most of that bottle of vodka I had at home, which has saved more than one life. I went back to the hospital. I did this 3-hour operation and a blackout, and I'm pleased to tell you he's still alive and a friend of mine today. But I told you how intelligent I was, and I made a very intelligent decision when I left the hospital that day, because I was shaking inside, and I said, "I think I'll give up surgery and take up drinking full time." And nobody was sorry about that, I don't think, at the time. What I did decide was that I was going to drink myself to death. I went out into British Columbia, into the pass, and started to drink for about 6 weeks. I had another accident, broke my arm again, and came back. And it was around this time that I remembered a meeting I had with a young journalist 2 years before. And I'd known him as a two-fisted drinker. He tore apart one of the medical clinics in our town with his bare hands. And finally, he had sobered up, and I said, "You know, you're writing some beautiful things these days." And he said, "I'm an alcoholic, Tom." He said, "And I joined Alcoholics Anonymous a year ago." And with all my intelligence, I said, "Jim, I'm really sorry to hear that." Yeah? And had another drink. But he came into my mind this night, and I was alone by this time, and I was sick. I had my cast, and I don't know why it is we phone when we have our lowest resources, we make that telephone call. And I called Jim. I was told later it was about 9 o'clock at night, and I told him I wanted a little of what you have. And he asked me, and listen to this, he said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "Of course I've been drinking." He says, "How long have you been drinking?" I said, "I've been drinking for weeks." And he said, "I'll be right there." And I know if Jim hadn't come over that night, I would not be alive today. Jim became my first sponsor in this program and died at the age of 31. He had brain surgery. And we spent lots of time together. And on his dying bed, he told me, "Would you go back and tell those turkeys to be gentle with themselves?" He thought we are a little too hard on ourselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was sure a super sponsor. He took me to that first meeting. I think I took the first step. I told him I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. He took me down to this chapter house, and I walked into that room and I scanned it. And on the wall there were lovely signs like, "Isn't it swell to be here?" And I thought I was condemned to bread and water for life. And this old man came up to me, Mel, who was the founder of AA and Lesbos. He put his arm around me, and I didn't like that. And he said he was glad to see me, and I didn't believe it. And he said he loved me, and I wanted to find out where the back door was. But he was a fine old chap. He gave me a penny. His name was Friend, a penny from a friend, and I still have this in my pocket today. I don't remember much about the first meeting. I remember Mel telling me three words: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And he said if I came to these crazy meetings, gave me a big book, and followed the principles of this program, that I would gain the respect of my colleagues, I would put my life together. And I thought the man was totally insane. I sat down at the table, I looked across, and there was a man there with eyeballs like billiard balls. White, big white eyeballs. And I wanted his eyeballs. And I was willing to go to any length to get those eyeballs. Because if you had seen my eyes for the 5 years before that, going into the hospital. Well, I went home after the meeting. All I remember was the eyeballs. And I picked up this big book and opened it, and lo and behold, what does it say there? The doctor's opinion. Who needs the doctor's opinion? So I skipped that chapter. And Bill's story, nobody I knew was Bill, so I skipped that. And I went straight to, there is a solution, of course, you know. And I'm glad it says solution here, because an answer, we know the answer, you quit drinking. If you have a problem with drinking, you quit drinking. I could never do it. Solution takes some work. And there's lots of work in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's lots of work to do. I've met lots of people, and I've buried lots of people who were too bright for this program. I've never buried anybody who was too dumb to get this program. I've had lots of people I've spoken to, and I've looked into their eyes and given them the best message I was capable of, and then I've seen them days later lying on that slab in the hospital, blue and with a big label tied around a big toe. And I say, why? Why do I get this, and why do these people die? And I've seen many people like that. I met a man on New Year's Eve. He told me, he's slipping and sliding. He said, "Tom, I would stop drinking if I could really believe down here that it can kill me." And the 5th of January, I went out to the place of business, and he was frozen dead. 5 days later from that remark. These are the things that keep us coming to the program. I got involved. They told me go to meetings for 18 months. I must have been a bad case. It wasn't a 90-day case. So I was dumb enough to go to a meeting every night for 18 months. And I wore the top off the pool table with all these guys coming in, coming and going, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was about 3 months in the program. At 3 a.m, the phone rang, and it was a disc jockey from the radio station, and he said, "Are you the alcoholic doctor?" And I said, "Well, I've been called worse." And he said, "There's a young guy has called me, and he has a shotgun. He has a problem with alcohol, and he's going to kill himself. Would you like to go over and speak to him?" So I dressed. I went over about 3:30. I found the home. There was a light in the back kitchen. And I walked around. I opened the door, stepped in, and there was the loudest explosion I've ever been close to in my life. And he blew the kitchen cabinet away above my head with his 12-gauge. And it was then I realized what an asset it is to be 5'4". Tall. Tim, before he died, taught me about the powerlessness of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, I work from an attitude, a posture of powerlessness. I'm powerless over people. I'm powerless over my family. I'm powerless over the outcome of my surgery. Our dilemma, as has been said all weekend, is a lack of power. And I came to believe in a very few weeks sitting at the tables that I was plugged in to some kind of power. I couldn't believe that I was staying sober this number of days, and I could feel the power that was coming from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no problem with insanity. I was anxious, depressed, manic at times, paranoid, thought everybody knew how many drinks I had the night before. I can reclaim all of that insanity. I can get edgy again, irritable, anxious, rude, depressed, manic, paranoid, the whole works. I can claim it all back. I had a real problem with this God bit of this program. I could not come to believe and turn my life over to a God of my understanding, because I just had no understanding of anything. This was the period I traveled over the country. I call the paralysis of analysis. I read all the religions of the world. I went to see Father Barney from Palo Alto. He gave me great advice. He said, hang your brain on the line to dry for a year, Tom, and come back to speak to me. And I could have poked him in the eye. And he was right. And I came back and I asked him, I said, how do you make a decision to turn your will over to the care of God? He said, you took Latin at school, decidere, trees, the deciduous trees, the leaves fall. It's a pruning process, making this decision. He said, you trim away all the things that stand between you and a conscious contact with God. My younger brother is an artist, and he told me when Michelangelo carved the statue of David, people admired it and said, how did you ever conceive of such a beautiful piece of art? And Michelangelo is reported to have said, I cut away everything that wasn't David. I cut away everything that wasn't David. So this was a door that opened me into some decision. By this time, I could see some of the wonderful and appreciate some of the wonderful things around me in nature, like we were talking about. I could see something of the painter behind the painting and the musician behind the music. And I was slowly beginning to develop my own understanding of a higher power. I took an inventory, and it took me too long in this fellowship. And at this point, I had that moment of clarity Cliff mentioned. In fact, I looked at myself and I looked through myself. I could see the deceit, the phoniness, the infidelity, the filth of alcoholism. I took my first step to a young Irish priest, no big deal, in this fellowship in a parking lot. And I spilled my guts to Joe, and he turned around to me. I told him my dilemma, and he said, Tom, he said, I think you only have one problem. He said, God broadcasts on FM, and I think you're tuned into AM. But he said, keep listening. So I kept listening at the meetings. The fourth step of this program gives us an insight that I wish 90% of my patients had. I wish the people who come to me could see themselves like we can when we do this step. And it's so important for us all, as it stresses in the big book. You know, Socrates said thousands of years ago that the unexamined life is not worth living. And we would agree with that. If we were buried the day before we came here, I think we could live with that or die with that on a tombstone. This man's life was not worth living. When I come to the 6 and 7 steps in my lifetime, it was the most painful period of my life. Because Mel's prophecies had all come true. I had become chief of the medical staff. I had become chief of surgery. I had a little farm. My children, horses, dogs, cats. A la dog, a la cat. But I had no communication still with my wife. I went to the meetings, and she had decided in 1975 to go to university. In 1977, I opened my mail in the office, and there was a letter that said she would never come back, and she never did. Well, I was pretty crushed. I was very angry. I was angry at your promises. I was angry at Alcoholics Anonymous. I was angry with everybody. When the boys elected to stay with me, and my daughter was being taken away, she was 8 years old, little blonde gal, and I held her so tight, I can still feel it. And at this time in my life, I went into what Mac would call the deserts, that we have in our life. And I traveled, I'll give you an idea, I traveled to Calgary to speak to my wife, and on the way back, the ice tree had fallen in my car, and the carpet was on fire, and my right trouser leg was on fire, and I didn't even know it. And that's in sobriety. I was so sick, I said, if there is a God, I want to die, because I don't want to build this up again. I don't want to go through this again. I built my life up once, and I can't handle it. And the children were disturbed, uncomfortable, uneasy, unhappy, and I just didn't know if I'd have the strength to do it all again. But I did, at this time in my life, come into conscious contact with a loving God as I know my God today. And I found out a few interesting things. He was not enjoying my misery, and he has no intention of inflicting pain on anybody. I had been a surgeon for 25 years, and I'd always operated to improve the quality of somebody's life in some way. I'd never even meditated on the pain I was causing when I did that surgery. It never crossed my mind. I knew it happened, but my goal was always to improve in some way the quality or quantity of someone's life. And I think this is God's intention too. It's the last thing on his mind, the byproduct of pain. I saw the steps in a new way, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step, I realized I had a disease. In steps 2 and 3, I picked my surgeon. In step 4, we did the investigations. In step 5, I sat down and we gave him informed consent. And in step 6 and 7, he gave me the knife. And I think the amend steps have something to do with the healing in this program when we make our amends, because there has been a lot of healing in my life and around me. I think I could call myself a little more mature now. I think once asked a child what is an adult, and she said, it's someone who stops growing at both ends and starts growing in the middle. And I like to think I have a more adult view of life now than I had then. I know at the depths of my being today that I have a God who loves me just the way I am and loves me too much to leave me this way. And he's changing so many people in front of me in so many lives that I have to share a few of them with you. As I say, making amends is not making apologies. This is part of the healing. If you go to work late every morning and say you're sorry, they'll fire you. There was an alcoholic who used to be late, told his boss he couldn't sleep at night. And his boss says, well, go to the doctor and get a sleeping pill. So one's good, he took two. Came in quarter to the hour in the morning and he said to his boss, look, I'm 15 minutes early today. The boss says, yes, but where were you all day yesterday? We tend to overdo our medication a little bit in this program too. And I'm not going to say much about doctors. I don't know if there are any of you out there. I did go to a psychiatrist in the late days of my drinking. He poured me a big glass of scotch and says, let's discuss your alcoholism now. So we had a few drinks together. He did tell me one cute story about an alcoholic who had this recurring nightmare. He was turning into a set of living room drapes. And the doctor said to him, my God, man, pull yourself together. Well, that's what he told me, Cliff. He told me to pull myself together. I was in the corridor of the hospital the other day and I said to one of the surgeons, what did you operate on that guy in 201 for today? He says, for $500. I said, you stupid clown, I'm not asking you that. I said, what did he have? He said, I think he's got about $500. They were a great bunch. A great bunch of guys. Well, we make our amends when we come to continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. We're beginning to get some of the promises of the fellowship by this time, and we're beginning to be able to forgive ourselves and other people through forgiving other people. We begin to forgive ourselves. And through that came the healing I was speaking about, and through the healing comes this love that had eluded me all my life. Because there is no love without healing. You can't love in hate and disharmony, and there is no healing without forgiveness, and there's no freedom without love. And this program is the gateway to freedom if you want to come this far to step 10. In step 11, we seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we come to understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will, as B said the other night. Knowledge of His will, some divine intelligence, a little bit of brighter thinking, and the motor power to carry it out. I learned in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and nowhere else that you'll ask yourself a question, God is everything or God is nothing in your life. I lived as God is nothing for 59 years. And then it's very simple. As Dr. Bob says, if you decide, you'll try, God is everything. And prayer, you can complicate if you like to complicate it, but it's just communication. It's just like the gal on Friday night who was communicating to the deaf. It's just a network of everything we do, and prayer is everything too. So we should have no problem with that. And if you start to pray, God doesn't need our prayers, and God certainly didn't need all our directions. But if you pray and become, prayer is really a way of life, prayerfulness anyway, nothing to do with formalities. It's just how you live, like Chuck used to say, what's your religion, Chuck? He would say, it's how I live. And this is simple. Every great idea, the big book says, is very simple. And prayer is everything that we do. And if you stick around this long like Silky, you'll have picked up some of the qualities, some of the courage that you've been praying for in the Serenity Prayer, some of the guts you need to stick around here. And Silky saw one of the first miracles, Bill Wilson, and you'll see miracles if you stay around. They're all miracles, but you'll see some stunners around if you stick in AA. Silky was a very courageous man, by the way. To stand up at that time when there was just a handful of alcoholics and to face the medical community and say, watch these people, they have the answer to this problem. Or however he put it. Bill had a sudden spiritual experience, which I didn't have. Mine is the waking up, slow, reluctant variety, like you're reminded on a Sunday morning of a mother who's calling to her son and saying, "Would you get up for church? Get up for church." And she says, "Tell me, son, give me two reasons why you won't go to church." And he says, "Well, I'm exhausted and nobody likes me down in that church." She said, "Tell me two reasons to go down there." And his mother said, "Well, you're 55 years old and you're the pastor of that church." I was a little reluctant in my spiritual growth like that. This pastor we have in Lethbridge was telling me as I left, he's having so many shotgun weddings this year that he's changing the name of the church to Winchester Cathedral. Incredible. I was looking after a young man in August of 1980. He had been in the hospital for 8 months. He was 70 pounds in weight. He was jaundiced. He had a liver the size of this podium, and all the specialists said he was going to die. And I went to see Terry and I told him he was going to die. I had to go to Vancouver. And I suggested that he speak to his pastor. And I went to Vancouver, and when I came back a week later, he had fully recovered physically. He had no jaundice, liver was down, he was eating, gaining weight. And I managed to tease out of him with difficulty, that night after I left, there was a light in his room, there was a voice that we read about. And all it said was he was going to be all right. "You're going to be all right, Terry." Now, people have tried to explain these occurrences because they are very common. If you go around the country, you'll find a lot of people have these certain experiences. And Terry has never had a drink since. His father died of alcoholism. His brother died a month ago, younger brother, of alcoholism. And he hasn't drank for the last 7 years. And that's a powerful, powerful spiritual experience. However, as I say, it's a little different. I had a call from my mother back in 1973. And she said my father was dying, and I called the doctor and he told me not to come. He wasn't that bad. And before I could hang up the telephone, there was that voice in my head said, "Why would you wait?" So I skipped the plane. I was in Scotland the next morning, Saturday morning. Spent a lovely day talking to my father about everything. And on Sunday morning, he was dead. And we talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me he had never met any of you people, and he said, "Would you go back and tell these people I love them?" And he died. I brought my mother over in 1980 to Canada. My sister said, "If you bring her over, she'll die, Tom. She's too old to come." And she came over, and she was a terminal case of Al-Anonitis, the worst I've ever seen. She hated all her wives because they had spoiled these beautiful three sons and made them alcoholics. And I used to shake her, and I thought after 2 weeks I was going to kill her. I was sure of it. And I dragged her to Al-Anon meetings, 86. And I took her to all these meetings and nothing happened. And then one night she actually did have a cardiac arrest. I took her to the hospital. Her heart had stopped beating. And I walked down the corridor, I left her with the young doctors giving her electricity and all that good stuff. And I walked down the corridor and I was just thinking at that time about our friend Mac. And 3:34 a.m. and I was just thinking about my sister's comments about sending her home in a casket. And I was thinking about Mac Cheetah, who had added a new dimension to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. Because before Mac died of cancer, and his son had died of cancer of the leg, he stood a few days before he died, and he talked us into the eternity of this program. Mac used to say, "This is too big a deal for one lifetime. Too big a deal." And he used to tell me that love If it is love at all, is everlasting, is eternal love, it makes no sense to be picked up and then dumped at the end of your life. And I think I believe that. And he told me that love is stronger than death, and I believe that. I was thinking of Mac and another saying of his in that hospital corridor, and it was, man's extremity is God's opportunity. And I said it a few times, and a young doctor came running down the corridor to me and he said, your mother's heart started to beat. I said, that's impossible. She drowned her lungs. And she did. She recovered consciousness a couple of days later, and we took her back to Scotland, and she died 10 months later. And the miracle I want to tell you is about, she got the program. She had 10 months of Al-Anon. My sister called me and said, what happened in Canada? I said, well, she had a cardiac arrest. She said, I'm not talking about that. She said, she's phoning everybody and saying how much she loves them, and it's driving us all crazy over there. And she told me the night before she died on the telephone again, it's lovely to speak to you, and Teresa, you've made my day. You know, my friend Dr. Paul, he says the first, he'd like to have a hit at Al-Anon. And our group, the one I'm a member of, is called the Adam Group, because Paul once told us that there had to be a first alcoholic, and the first alcoholic was Eve. He said, if you think about it, who else would get into that cider and go down the path and have a conversation with a snake? With an alcoholic. So I was thinking later about Adam walking past the Garden of Eden with Cain and Abel, and it's all covered in weeds, and he's saying, this is where your mother drank us out of house and home, you know? So it all makes a lot more sense in the way he taught me. And I noticed the first reference to electronics in the Bible, when God took a rib from Adam and turned it into a loudspeaker. Well, if you think that's bad, I had an old Al-Anon lady who brought her husband in a few weeks ago. She said, he's getting very deaf. I examined him. I said, it's worse than that. He's falling apart. But the man needs his lots more sex to brighten him up. And the old fellow said, what did the doctor say, dear? He says, you're going to die, dear. Paul and I went to a talk. He went to a talk on Not Tonight, Dear, or something it was called, Sex and Alcoholism. And we found out why Al-Anons keep their eyes closed during sex. They can't stand to see an alcoholic enjoy him. I must finish soon, but I have to tell you another miracle very close to my heart. My younger brother was an artist in London, went through drugs and alcohol. I got a phone call in 1975. He was in Brixton prison. I flew over there and I stood outside the prison for a week, and they wouldn't let me come in. I stood in the rain in that miserable place, and they gave me a new excuse every day why I couldn't see him. He was so badly beaten. And I talked him through magistrate's court, and I said I'd take him to Canada, and I brought him over here, and I asked him if he thought alcohol had anything to do with his problem, and he said yes. I said, would you go to an AA meeting? And he said yes. And I took him and I sat in powerlessness, and I watched you people work for an hour. And he walked out of that meeting with me, and I turned around and he jumped 3 feet into the air, and he said, Tom, that's what I've been looking for all my life. And he's been in this fellowship since that time. And today he's the cartoonist with the largest newspaper in London. And he's so full of gratitude, it bubbles out of the telephone when he speaks to me. It's just a beautiful miracle. He had been picked up by the police, thrown in a garbage can, and he came to you, and this is what he is today. And we hope to see him really soon. In 1978, I was looking after the kids. I don't know how they survived. I have one of my sons, Alan, down here. I don't know how he ever survived. He's the one who went into my washer dryer His older brother put him in as a kid and said he was going into the time tunnel. And I extracted him from the dryer, spinning around with his eyeballs sticking out. And then one night he said, "Dad, I'd like to sleep outside in the lawn." And I said, "That's a good idea. It's a warm night." It happened to be the 18th of May, 1980. And he's got a quarter of an inch of Mounts and Helens down his lungs. He woke up covered in this white stuff and came staggering into the house, you know. So I just don't know how they survived, these kids of mine. In any case, I have been trying to single parent for several years, and I was in Kalispell. And after I spoke, a beautiful girl came up to me, and she said she identified with what I had to say. And I said, "Well, bring your husband, and we're going for some ice cream now." And she said, "I don't have a husband." And I'm getting smarter by this time. And I said, "I'm really sorry to hear that." So, Chris and I have become a team. We were married in 1982. And she had three children after the Vietnam War. I have four. So, between us, we have seven children. And then you need a program. Would you stand up, Chris? There are many, many miracles in our life, and I'm really proud of what this living has done for my children, my ability to be around and alive and witness it. Really proud. My oldest son, the one who used to twitch, is a lawyer in Toronto now, an articulate lawyer, and Alan, he's teaching music. I could be here all day boasting about all our children. And they've been a real joy in my life, the greatest. Myself, I've achieved, I think, everything I ever dreamed about. I did a lot of dreaming too, Hank. In fact, I bought that bloody Continental, you know. She only drove it once. But anyways, I always had a wish to get my triple crown. I have a Scottish surgery degree and a Canadian one. So this year I decided, why not, let's go for the American Fellowship in Surgery, and I got it. And this October... this October, God willing, in San Francisco, they're going to cap and gown this little drunken turkey. And I really have a tremendous respect and admiration for this country and for you people. I always have had. I've always admired the American experiment, which is so misunderstood. You're the most beautiful people in the world. You have much to be proud of, and certainly you do, the people who are here today. So I continue on my way through this fellowship. And when we come to the 12th step, we do what we're doing today. I come to tell you my Father loves you. I come to give back some of what was given to me. I'm always reminded of a couple of sayings of Mother Teresa of India. Someone mentioned this weekend. And she said, "You can't give what you don't live. You can't give what you don't live." And she also says, "We are not called to be successful, we're called to be faithful." And I think success is not what you get in life, it's what you overcome in life. Success for us is what we overcome, and we are not looking for anything at the other end. My father was a coal miner, as I told you, and when we were young, he used to take lots of time to meditate on coal because he dug it for 8-10 hours a day. And we were children, he used to show it to me, and he said, "Look at the miracle of this cold, inert substance here, useless, tasteless. Thousands of years ago, on sunny days around places like this, the sun was beating down on trees, and they grew, they flourished, they fell, and over centuries they become coal." He said, "You just put a spark to this and you light a fire and it returns a century-old debt of light and heat back to the sun. And that is quite a miracle when you think about it. And I lived a dead spiritual life for 39 years. And on the 13th of April, 1972, there was a spark in me, for which I'm grateful. I came to you, and you lit my fire. And I come back to you to return some of my debt of experience, light. And if I'm not transparent, it's not going to come through to you. And I've tried to be transparent to you today. And I return to you some of my debt of warmth, of love. And God bless you.
Give her a warm welcome.
Hi, my name is Carla, and I'm a member of I'm a member of Allerton. My sister and my dad are alcoholics, and I thought they were the only problems in my family. And when I was a little kid, I thought a normal family was supposed to be like the Brady Bunch. But it wasn't like that, and so I decided to run away. But I knew I couldn't because I had to know what was going on in my whole family. I eavesdropped to find out why this had to happen to me. I also wanted to know how I could stop it and what I could do about it. I met a friend at school, and she asked me if she could come over to my house. And I just kept making excuses for not to come, you know. And after I had used each excuse at least 3 times, she asked me, well, what's the real reason you don't want me at your house? And I told her everything. And I just exploded, and all my feelings came rushing out. They had been bottled up for so long. And all she could say was, oh. But it felt good inside. And I just started all over again, bottling up my feelings. And then I just kept exploding again. And that got a little old and a little embarrassing at school. And when my parents told my sister either move out of the house or go into treatment, she went into treatment, and I got my hopes up real high, and I really wanted her to make it. But after a couple of weeks, she was kicked out of treatment because she got high. And I felt let down, frustrated. And my sister came back to our house. And she was still a rotten sister. She asked if she could go back into treatment. She did, and this time she made it. I felt surprised because I didn't think she could do it, and she did, and I was really happy. After I'd been in the program for about a year, I guess my higher power wanted me to really accept things because my dad told me he was an alcoholic. And I didn't accept that for about 3 months. And I had never seen him drunk. Well, I probably did and didn't want to see it, or I was just too busy with my sister. And when a lot of thoughts went through my mind, you know, when I came to Alateen, I thought I was different. I thought, I don't have an alcoholic parent. And so he told me this, and that just really screwed that up, you know. I mean, it was all his fault, too. You know. There was a big resentment about it. And then I was really mad because that meant I could have the genes to be an alcoholic myself. So I decided that couldn't be true. And so when I finally did accept that my dad was an alcoholic, I'd go back and I'd re-accept all these things that I had learned in the program. Today, that friend that I met at school is now in the program and has an alcoholic sister and a dad. And she has showed me that not all alcoholics recover. And I thought all alcoholics recover. And I had told her that her sister would recover. And at that time, she didn't really want to see her dad was an alcoholic, but today she has accepted that. And I guess I had told her, you know, it'll be okay, everything will work out, you know, just like my sister did. Or is, whatever. she said, well, Carla, it's been 3 months and it's not working, you know, and so I said, well, be a little more patient, you know. And still, today, she's not recovering, but she also made me realize that not all alcoholics recover, and I guess that's what really made me realize was that her sister is not recovering. And I guess that helped a lot. Also today, I have a pretty good relationship with my sister and with my dad. And that makes me really happy. Thank you.
He's now going to give us another talk. Zoe?
Hi, my name is Zoe. And if you see me looking down at my papers, because I get lost. Before I came to Alateen, it wasn't really that bad because I didn't know the alcohol that my parents were drinking could really hurt them or really even kill them. I had a lot more things to do than really worry about what they were doing. The excuse for my parents drinking was that they had nothing to do. Well, they had nothing to amuse themselves, and that's what they had to amuse themselves. And really, it was sometimes fun because I got a lot of things just to leave them alone. And but after, when my parents were still drinking, they all our problems were really much the same. They weren't all different. And most of it was just because they had nothing really to, just things to do. They always had something to drink, and I never knew it really could hurt them. And when I started to come into Alex Teens, and my parents were in AA and NA and Al-Anon, it got a lot different. My family started to fight a lot more. And we started to really get abusive in my family. We started to fight a lot more, and everybody was right, and everybody still is. And me and my sister, Katie, are really abusive to each other. We're always fighting, scratching, and I always tell everybody that I have a new animal in my house. And we had to go to work with my dad one day, and he was paying us $5 to do it, and we were sitting in the car, and I think most of it's because we were so bored. I had scratches along my face, and she's only 6 years old, and she just lays down on me and takes fingernails and runs them through my face. And we're always fighting, we're always in timeout, and I just, I wish sometimes I could stop fighting with her, but it's so hard to see in the face. Like, she has this face that I just want to squeeze. And sometimes I really think that I want to be an only child, but then I think, well, okay, we're fighting today, and what if she, passes away tomorrow? What am I going to do? But I really love her, and that's what matters. And when I started to come to Alexine, I really didn't like that word at all. I didn't really think it was fun. I just thought this group was a bunch of bull. I didn't really like it at all. I didn't care for it, and I didn't really think it would help me. I'd come home every night, and my parents would say, "How was it?" And I'd say, "Terrible," or "I don't care. It's stupid. I don't, But Allison helped me to really know that it's really helping me, because I can talk to whoever I want. Maybe I can't talk to my parents as really that much, because maybe because I'm related to them. I don't know. Allison taught me to really love my parents and know that they're doing the best they can. Thank you.